Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. This week, in our first episode after the election, we have Julius Krein, the editor of American Affairs Journal, one of the smartest quarterly publications that's been writing about these realignment topics ever since the 2016 election. A lot of speakers who you've seen on this podcast have been featured, and Julius himself is a really deep thinker, so it was great to talk with him immediately afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's great getting Julius's perspective. Some of you might have heard him on Ezra Klein's podcast. We've known him for years. He is somebody I would consider one of the intellectual kind of fathers of this movement, whatever it is you want to call it, of realignment politics, of Trumpism itself, although I'm definitely sure we all would distance ourselves from that exact definition. But he's somebody who thinks very deeply about institutions, financial markets, about how different institutions on the right might adapt and change politics in order to work to build better things in America on the backs of a coalition predominantly of the American working class. And look, we're taping this. It's 12:59 p.m. on Wednesday. A lot of different states to be called. The Trump campaign apparently wants a recount in Wisconsin. There's only 20,000 votes there. We've got Michigan results rolling in. Pennsylvania is still unclear. Georgia is still unclear. Arizona's razor tight. So is Nevada. So look, we don't really know who wins. I'd rather be Joe Biden than Donald Trump right now. And the perspective of this conversation, hopefully, is not even really skewed by results. It's all just about within the prospect of the votes that we know now, we see very specific patterns. GOP likely to keep the Senate. How are they going to react if Joe Biden does become president? What does the future look like? What are the lessons there for the right as so many millions of working class Americans supported Donald Trump? That's the one thing which is absolutely clear after last night's results. So it's just a great conversation overall.
And the most important detail to add about Julius's background is that the publication he founded, American Affairs, was supposed to be the publication that put the meat on the bones of the Trump administration and populism. However, after the Charlottesville incident in August of 2017, Julius actually wrote a New York Times op-ed denouncing Trump. So that's the key thing to understand about him. As you go through this discourse, for good or for ill, depending on your perspective, he's not a hack. He, in many ways, is actually sort of laudatory of Joe Biden's industrial policy and infrastructure approaches. So he's definitely someone who could think about this issue in a way that isn't tied to personalities, which is something we need to be doing moving forward. But on to our realignment question before we get into the episode. So this question is from Daniel Richards. And a quick reminder, if you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and send us a screenshot of the review to realignmentpod@gmail.com, we will read it on air. You can also leave your question in the review. But on to Daniel's question. Good morning. I'm a new listener to The Realignment and a relatively new consumer of politics outside of the stuff mainstream media is pushing. I find myself agreeing with you guys on The Realignment as well as Rising. My question is, are there any books, articles, other podcasts, or blogs that you could recommend to someone who's taking their first stumbling steps into the world of populist ideas when it comes to politics? I consider myself right-leaning, but I want to get out of the echo chamber. Thanks, guys. Keep it up.
That's a really, really good question, and that's why you're here. You should listen to Julius. He's one of the people who's created a literal journal to answer all the questions that you're talking about. Go back and take a listen to our episode with episodes, plural, with Orrin Cass. He's another person who's working and creating an institution in order to build a new consensus and a policy idea around the things that we talk about here. Check out Michael Lind's book, The New Class War. That's another one, heavily influential. Overall, I think that this podcast can generally serve as a beacon in pointing you in the different and the correct directions. Look, the truth is there's not a professional infrastructure. There's not a reading list I can just point to you and say, this is what we believe, because we're all still figuring it out. And I think that there's a lot of beauty to that.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll add, because that's well said, Sagar, is that we actually will be putting together that reading list because we've gotten a couple questions from people. We're going to be launching our website in the next week or so, and the website will have a specifically dedicated section to sort of articles, blogs, pieces that we find interesting. So definitely look to see what we're doing there as well.
And as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Really appreciate all the work that they do there. The Reboot Conference is upon us, rebootconference.org. I'm going to be there. Rachel Bovard is going to be there. Many other friends of the show. So is Marshall. So make sure that you come and you check out some of those panels if you're interested. And with that, let us dive in.
Julius Krein, welcome to the Realignment.
Thank you very much.
It's good to see you, Julius.
So we're recording this the day after the election. So obviously we're going to offer a blanket get out of jail free card if anything detailedly changes. But at least from my sort of perspective, it looks like we are set for a Biden win. Do either you, Julius, or Sagar disagree with that?
Go ahead, Julius.
I think it's, you know, too early to tell. Does look like Biden's going to eke out a victory. But either way, whomever wins is going to be razor thin, and they're going to enter the office, I think, with a very hard time trying to claim a mandate.
Yeah, I generally agree. I mean, I think that's right. We are recording this, let's just click everybody, 12.04 p.m. On Wednesday. So at exactly this moment, this is what I can see right now, which is that, as far as I know, the polls closed in Wisconsin. There's no more votes to come out there. So that looks good for Joe Biden, who's got like a 20,000 lead there. Michigan as well. Pennsylvania is really kind of the wild card. And Arizona and Georgia are still too close to call and haven't come in. But I would much rather be Joe Biden than Trump today. And as far as I know, Trump basically only has one path to victory, where Arizona would have to flip back. So I generally actually agree with Julius, which is, and I think we should focus the conversation there, which is, what does a razor-thin, non-mandateless victory mean, right? Because that's just something which I don't think the political system was really prepared for. And yet, now here we are. Joe Biden could be the next president of the United States, and yet the GOP could keep the Senate. I mean, these are dynamics which we hadn't really thought about. Julius, one of the things I would love to hear from you is, what do you think that iteration of a GOP opposition in the Senate would look like to Joe Biden? And would it be a good thing or a bad thing for realignment politics that, like, we talk about here on the show?
I think the main question for answering both of those kind of sub questions is, what does a potential Biden administration attempt to do? I was thinking about it earlier. If you go back to 2016, when Trump wins the first time, and even though the Electoral College wasn't that close, it was still a pretty divided country. And he sort of had a choice. He could prioritize things like infrastructure, some of the more populist economic agenda items, and one could imagine him splitting off a few Democratic senators, et cetera, being able to really drive a realignment agenda. Obviously, as we know, that did not happen. He went with healthcare repeal, tax cuts, some of the more kind of incendiary immigration stuff, and battle lines hardened. So In 2020, you know, it's theoretically possible to imagine Joe Biden prioritizing some of the industrial policy stuff that he campaigned on, a sort of serious infrastructure plan, not just pure Green New Deal stuff, but real building of infrastructure, you know, a good COVID stimulus kind of stuff. And I can imagine, you know, a few Republican senators who would absolutely not get rewarded for it, but I could see them, you know, believing in doing the right thing, going along with that. Maybe you get some kind of realignment. But you also have to look at the political landscape and say that that does seem like an unlikely outcome, even if it is a possible one.
Mm-hmm. Julius, American Affairs, the journal that you edit, has been deeply interested in the post-2016 political project in the U.S. So could you speak to the meaning of the 2016 election and your interpretation of its results, especially in the context of what happened last night and what's currently happening during the counting today? Because some would argue that the 2016 election represented this point of no return in American politics, but others could clearly look at the probable Biden victory and conclude that the opposite is true. So what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know who won yet, but I do know who lost. The people that lost are, of course, the conventional pollsters. And I would say this kind of idea of very, very woke racialized politics. Trump improves his vote total among every demographic group except white men. Who would have thought? And the sort of flip side of that is you see a greater consolidation along class lines, affluent suburbanites flocking to Biden. So, you know, you probably saw Josh Hawley's tweet from last night. The voter numbers, I think, you know, Republicans from a purely kind of partisan, we want to win standpoint, looks harder and harder to hold those suburbs. Some will take that direction, I think, of really trying to make it a true working class party. The challenge in all of this is the donors. And this is where I think the meaning of 2016 never really resonated, was never really fought out, because Trump never really did much to, I don't know if challenge is the right word, but even simply sort of realign the donors around new institutions, new policy goals, new styles of politics, whatever. And there's no meaningful donor base at this point for any kind of populist version of the GOP, populist in quotation marks, whatever. So that's the question. I mean, will some donors look at these results and say, well, this is clearly the direction the party's going, and, you know, I care about some other things other than tax cuts too, and I'm going to actually invest in some of these institutions to move the party in a different direction? Or will they look at it and say, yeah, we got to fight, we got to bring the suburbs back from the Democrats, we got to go back to Romney Ryan?
Yeah, Julius, this is the eternal question. And the real problem I have, which you just identified, is that the infrastructure of the entire professional right is geared towards doing that second outcome, which is, oh, like, we got to try and win back these suburbanites. We got to make sure, you know, Romney Ryan, even though Romney and Ryan, by the way, didn't win, you know, that's something that we somehow seem to forget. And that it's very possible that if you have a Senate GOP, that it's just all about making austerity great again. I mean, I was jokingly asking some friends, I'm like, who's the first senator to make a pointless filibuster about how the deficit is out of control in the year 2021, if Joe Biden does become the next president? So the question I have is that, do you think that the realignment is fleeting in terms of the voters? Because look, Donald Trump just won a higher percentage of non-white voters than any GOP nominee since the year 1960. Which
Nixon.
Again, Nixon was a great dude. We don't talk enough about it. But the interesting part to me about that is it seems like it could go away quite quickly too if we revert to the mean of 2010, which I think the entire infrastructure is built around. So first of all, I mean, do you agree with that? And second, in terms of building counter institutions as one of the only people who actually has, do you think that there's an impetus to do so if Biden would in fact become president and in the face of these austerity politics?
I generally do agree with that, but let me try to give a more optimistic spin on it just for the sake of conversation, if nothing else. In terms of the infrastructure, I think you're basically right, but there is a noticeable generational divide. And eventually generations do turn over, although with baby boomers, it seems to take a very, very long time. But who knows? The second part of it is that narrow losses tend to be, you know, good for greater self-reflection. And that's what it's looking like. And then finally, you know, on the most positive case you can say about the realignment, the populist moment of 2016, et cetera, is that Biden, at least rhetorically, at least in the superficial realm of campaign promises, incorporated a lot of this stuff, particularly industrial policy,
yes,
rebuilding U.S. industry vis-a-vis China. And ironically, or perhaps, you know, in a perfect illustration of the cunning of history, I think a lot of actually the most intelligent, competent, serious, quote unquote, technocrats have internalized a lot of this stuff and they're seriously thinking about it. So bizarrely enough, populism's greatest friend going forward may be in the, you know, the swamp, the technocracy, and some of these bureaucracies and even in the corporate world. And, you know, the other part of it is a question of, you know, absent a big donor base, it's hard for me to imagine realignment proceeding on the kind of mass politics level. But they could still function as kingmakers. And if you end up with a situation, whether it's a Biden or Trump, a narrowly divided Congress, you know, a so-called squad, shall we say, four or five senators or maybe like 10 senators from both parties really interested in some of this stuff could be immensely powerful.
Mm-hmm. Julius, can you speak to the ways that DC has and hasn't changed since Trump's election in 2016?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, no one was really talking about the problems of China as an emerging technological, industrial, economic, strategic rival. When Trump brought that up back in 2016, that was, you know, dismissed initially. Now, no one does that. One can question how sincere people are in trying to come up with policies to address the China problem, but there's very few people that completely dismiss it. And the other part of this is the thing that I always find most interesting is that there's all kinds of critique today about, you know, how American politics is, you know, plutocratic, deep state, driven by this bureaucracy, average person doesn't have any control. And the apparent solution to all that is to like try to go out and get more followers on social media or something. I actually take this critique seriously. So, you know, the positive side of some of this is that, you know, once the so-called elite or whatever starts to take some of this seriously, you have a greater chance to get it done. Now, of course, the other problem with the divided government, I saw this morning a pharma trade publication put out like a big article saying this is the greatest thing that could happen for us, because when you have this divided situation, it's very difficult to do things like drug price control that, you know, both sides have talked about. Right. It's just much easier to play groups against each other. And given that a lot of the populist issues require pretty big structural reforms at some level, that dynamic will be a huge obstacle to any reform. So we'll see which side wins, but I don't think it's totally hopeless within the DC, or let me put it this way, the DC bureaucracy and this sort of group has changed a lot since 2016.
This is one of the most key points that you made. I heard you on Ezra Klein's podcast making, which is that the future of populism might be technocratic. And that is inherently kind of contradictory in terms, but it's also not. Because I want you to expand on a point you made, which is that American modern history, basically since the New Deal era, is one-party rule. You have FDR who has, you know, he ushers in the New Deal, then Eisenhower is like a pro-New Deal Republican, then you have the Reagan Revolution, then Clinton is basically like a Reaganite Democrat, and now we could be entering a new era. How do you solidify the gains of whatever Trumpism, you could call it, you know, reaction to neoliberalism, you could call it any one of those things. How do you solidify that, Julius, within the technocratic elite? Because a lot of takes that we'll hear, probably from people who listen to this podcast, are going to be like, no, you know, these college-educated bureaucrats and others are too infected by like woke ideology and critical race theory to ever give any of our stuff a chance. Where would you see and sense some optimism for realignment politics becoming one-party rule in America?
The opportunity lies in the fact that all the people interested in critical race theory or whatever on both sides don't spend any time thinking about serious policy. Mm-hmm. But reality, you know, still marches on, and there's a need to do serious policy. And the fact that no one else is doing it means that, you know, so-called populists can actually do it. And in fact, you know, to the extent there's new thinking about a lot of these issues, it's being done by sort of populist thinkers. So, you know, even if you look at, you know, what Trump means in 2016, he wins this surprise victory. There's all this enthusiasm. On the big picture questions, it actually went almost nowhere. I mean, the most famous issue in 2016 was immigration, I think. And no one's even talking about that anymore. Mm-hmm. And where things actually were accomplished, you know, it was the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer doing stuff on, you know, very technical trade agreements with China and USMCA. You know, the best parts of what I would say of the tax cuts in 2017 were things like removing the state and local income tax deductions, or capping it, changing the rules around corporate debt tax deductibility. All these things, very technocratic parts of it that nobody really talked about. And so there's always a space, or, and, you know, most recently, if you look at some of the semiconductor legislation, investing in U.S. semiconductor manufacturing capacity, nobody really talked about that. So it's actually the stuff that no one, the media doesn't pay attention to, that there is not a lot of mass movements around where you can actually get things done. But the only way you get them done is by being able to formulate very concrete, serious policies. And there's an opportunity to do that because no one else is really paying attention. So if you look at stuff like, you know, Section 230, you know, involving liability on tech platforms, stuff like that. Amazingly, we had both candidates say they want to repeal Section 230 in the campaign. But actually getting from a broad big picture, we want to get rid of 230, to sort of rewriting 230, it's a long process that, you know, is going to be dominated by lobbyists and lawyers and technocrats. And if somebody can fill that gap, you know, who knows what can happen.
Let's talk about that. What would you like to see if Section 230 were reformed or abolished?
I would definitely, I mean, I think it's clear at this point that the tech platforms are no longer operating as neutral content providers or whatever.
Quick thing, because this is sort of my policy area, right? Like Section 230 doesn't require that they be neutral, right? So I think it's important that we sort of...
The point is that they are, they're not exercising editorial. They're not liable as long as they're not like producing and shaping and determining the content. They're just hosting the content.
I mean, if you look at what Section 230 is saying, like Section 230 is saying that they could, at least from my understanding, the issue of Section 230 is that they could shape they could moderate the platform however they sort of want. So I don't really know where this shaping comes in, because I think you're referring to sort of the distinction between a publisher and a platform, but that isn't a real distinction in the law, at least.
I mean, 230 obviously functions as kind of a symbol for the broader web of tech regulation. It's the most obvious.
I think that's the important part here, which is what you're addressing, which is that both sides agree there needs to be some legal reform around tech. And that in and of itself is, I mean, that's interesting. Anyway, go ahead.
You know, I actually think, you know, we have to accept the fact that these platforms exercise a disproportionate influence on what reaches the public and all of that. And the only plausible way to regulate them would be through an official government process, you know, presumably led by the FCC, maybe others. And the FCC actually did begin saying they were going to reinterpret 230 in different ways, although with the election, who knows where that ends up. But yeah, on the bigger picture of regulating tech, I mean, there's some issues where I think antitrust is very useful on, say, Facebook type of stuff. And there are some issues where, you know, a more intrusive government regulatory position is more useful. But I will say that, you know, in that respect, I focus more on the finance industry. I am not the right technocrat to be doing the 230 specific design, but I do know that somebody has to do it. And if both parties and all populists just sit around and talk about, oh, we need to do something about tech, but nobody actually goes through the deep dive process of coming up with the replacement language, it's not going to happen.
And that's what's so interesting about this moment, though. And this is, and a question I wanted to ask you is, could you, I'll say one thing, then ask you a question. If you're looking at the tech regulation area, though, I don't think there is a broad bipartisan populist critique. So, for example, if you're looking at how the left and even like Joe Biden, when they're talking about reforming or changing Section 230, their argument is that right now, platforms like Twitter and Facebook, like arguably don't censor enough. They would say that Twitter and Facebook are hotbeds of QAnon, they're hotbeds of disinformation. And right now, the platforms aren't liable for that. So we need to actually reform Section 230 and the broader internet to have that happen more. If you're looking at what the right is asking for, though, the right is actually saying right now the platforms are way too censorious. So right now the tech platforms are stopping the New York Post from sharing. They're obviously biased. They're obviously sort of run by the left. So there really isn't joint shared critique here. So my actual question for you then is, what do these terms like populist, what do these terms like the right, what do these terms like the left, what do they even mean in 2016, in 2020? Because it seems like there's a deep confusion about what they sort of mean.
Well, first of all, I'd say that there is common ground in the sense that both think that the privatized tech monopolies are too powerful And that's actually fine with me. I don't care if you want to break up Facebook because you think it doesn't censor enough or it censors too much, as long as you're breaking it up. And on in terms of the, you know, I've always been, or, you know, I've been saying for a long time that right and left means absolutely nothing to me. At this point, you know, the left, you know, it functions as kind of an enforcer of morality, perhaps counterintuitively. And the sort of far left seems to function as kind of the most ultra orthodox kind of radical religious movement. And, you know, behind that is actually a concentration of the most elite, strongest segments of the economy. And the right is kind of everybody else, the so-called losers of the current consensus and of really kind of the post-Cold War period, ranging from kind of natural resources CEOs to kind of old Wall Street dinosaurs whose business models are on the decline. And then of course to just social conservatives and, you know, now kind of the refugee working class and all that. But I think the kind of moralized ideological, you know, people that are sort of proud to identify as right and left, that makes no sense to me at all.
This is something, you said something interesting earlier, Julius, about just being okay with a regulatory environment. That's so heretical to so much of the professional right. This is something I'm curious, which is that given how deep of a strain kind of libertarian free market fundamentalism is to so much, not of the professional right, but I would also say the median GOP lawmaker, which I really learned in the middle of all these COVID stimulus negotiations, how do you think we message this better to a free market, libertarian, more minded person? Let's go to your special issue of finance. How would you make the case to one of those lawmakers? Because ultimately, I mean, you're going to have to get some of them to vote for and enact and support some of your agenda.
Well, for the average GOP lawmaker, it's not that hard because the finance industry is donating much more to their opponents. Mm-hmm. So everyone is ideological to a certain extent, but you know when you're actively carrying water for an industry that is out trying to defeat you, you know, that has to register eventually. And I think what the GOP has not yet woken up to is the fact that they still think that the morality of capitalism is the, you know, so-called bourgeois virtues. I think there's an AEI and Heritage conference on bourgeois virtues like every other day. but that's no longer relevant anymore. Capital, if you will, doesn't need that. The affluent don't do it, you know, don't use that to justify their position. And like, if you look, for example, I live in the Boston suburbs, you know, there are all kinds of movements to block new development in the Boston suburbs, but they're all based on environmentalism and various left-wing ideas. On Wall Street, you know, it's the finance industry generally embraces all these causes, and most recently is doing things, you know, it's called ESG, environmental social governance, which we can get into more later. But, you know, essentially this is basically an idea with left-wing origins. And why, mm-hmm. why are they doing that? Why are they inviting more regulation on themselves? But truthfully, you know, average financial manager has underperformed, you know, the index, whatever, for the last 20 years, who knows? They don't want to talk about their returns. They don't want to talk about low taxes. They want to go and talk about ESG because that's how they're justifying themselves getting paid as a manager. We're better at ESG. So all of the Republican talking points about capitalism and freedom and bourgeois virtues are no longer of any interest to capital. And eventually, I think the average Republican ideologue has to figure out that the people they think they're supporting and carrying water for not only don't like them, but are not even using their ideology to support their basic money-making function.
Yeah, I mean, this was something I was really struck with by in this campaign, is that Wall Street actually donated a record amount of money to Joe Biden's campaign. And actually, most of the billionaires and the financial ones who backed Trump around in 2016 abandoned him completely. And yet, it seemed like so much of his administration was actually spent trying to both impress them and to, you know, kind of almost win a social cachet amongst them. I'm not sure, though, if he necessarily will have learned that lesson and if other professional Republican lawmakers will. And the question is how out of control and how much of a left behemoth is the financial industry becoming before the time kind of runs out in terms of what can be done against it? What do you think?
I don't know, but if they don't figure out, they're eventually going to start losing elections. So one way or another, they'll be gone,
right?
Or they'll change.
It seems to me that the socialism versus capitalism debate has become inextricably tied up in the culture war. How much does that debate prevent people on the right from thinking critically about capital?
I think the socialism thing, the culture war aspect of it, you know, is probably pretty generational. And that might just be something that, you know, there's not much you can do until the generations change a bit more. But then there's also the question of, you know, mass politics versus technocratic politics. And I think at the in the latter case, on the technocratic side, those issues don't mean as much anymore.
This is another thing, Julius, I'm interested in terms of realignment politics, which is that losing elections should be the ultimate impetus in order to change behavior, in order to change so much more. And yet the developmental timeline in politics just seems to lag so many of these fast-paced industries which are growing, like finance, Silicon Valley, and so much more. What do you think the role of kind of, this is one of the things that you're most famous for, is your scathing critique of the GOP kind of intellectual class. Do you think that that can and will be affected by this election? Are they just too shameless to not even look at some of the things that we're talking about here? And in general, what damage has that done to trying to evolve with the times?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, they've been irrelevant for so long anyway that I don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. And I don't know how much they really will matter. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting because I think you are, in terms of a lot of the intellectuals, they are shifting on a lot of the economic stuff slowly, gingerly, you know, but it's actually very few of the intellectual class that's really energized by Reagan tax cuts anymore. But, you know, that they actually just don't really matter that much. So we'll see. Mm-hmm.
A theme that we're talking about is the GOP politicians and bases trying to reconsider the way they approach issues when class and education are becoming more salient. How do you think an issue like campaign finance changes on the right, or does it change at all? Because we've actually gotten this question from sort of younger populist types who are seeing the Wall Street dynamic.
I suspect that it won't change for a while, in part because while most of the financial industry and so on has departed from the Republican Party a long time ago, that actually makes them increasingly reliant on sort of a smaller number of very large individuals. I don't really see anything happening here. I mean, the other part of this is that I would be quite surprised if anything really significant in terms of legislation happens for the foreseeable future. I think it's, you know, we'll probably get some kind of COVID stimulus, and it'll presumably be smaller than what people were thinking, and given the division, very, very contentious, and who knows what can make it in there, but probably nothing too ambitious. And beyond that, it's hard to see any significant legislation passing anytime soon.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the things which is depressing in a way. And this goes me back to a question that we were just talking about with the technocratic elite, which is how much of a realignment agenda is legislative and how much of it is administrative, or is the best way to think about it a fusion of the two? Because I just don't see over the next 10 years passing any sort of huge government legislation. I'm just not sure how things can line up. Look, I could obviously be wrong and they could play this tape back and I could look like an idiot. But if CARES Act is as good as it's going to get, which I think was good at the time, but, you know, I think there should have been a lot more done after that. What do you think that we should be thinking about the role of the administrative state here. And again, how would we grapple with a 30 or 40 year ideology, which has waged war on the administrative state as a means of exercising power on the right?
Well, I'm reminded of a joke kind of from more from 2016, which is, you know, if the neocons declare war on Trump, like, you know, he's got nothing to worry about. It won't be any more successful than all their other wars. You know, if people want to declare war on the administrative state, you know, look, you know, they can do it, but it's gotten them absolutely nowhere. And the only successes Trump achieved are with the administrative state. And I think even a lot of those people have recognized that when it comes to issues they really care about, like, say, regulating the universities or, you know, free speech in the universities, the only tools they have are with the administrative state. But I mean, it's definitely that ideological problem is an issue. It's going to go on for a while. And, you know, it's not totally ungrounded. There's a reason why it's popular. But, you know, in an ideal world, you'd obviously have both administrative and legislative realignment. But like you said, absent some kind of disaster, which is what precipitated the CARES Act. And of course, right. Like, there's probably going to be some disasters inevitably. But absent that, it's hard to see a lot of significant legislation passing. Again, unless Biden or whoever ends up being the president decides to take the really unlikely avenue of going down the populist route and trying to piece together a sort of populist coalition, which is theoretically possible.
Yes.
Speaking of neocons, where do they go after this election? I'm thinking of the Bulwark. I'm thinking of the Lincoln Project. Where do you think that specific project goes after this?
Given how, you know, it wasn't just that they criticized Trump, which I think, you know, they could have gotten away with because everybody's criticized Trump, including, you know, most of the people that he's appointed to senior cabinet level positions. I think they could have gotten away with that. But because they turned it into not only Trump, but attacking Republican senators and congressmen, going after the Supreme Court issue, most of them basically calling the entire Republican Party a bunch of racists, I just think it'd be very difficult for them to be welcome back in that party. And given that most of them presided over some of the most egregious foreign policy failures and were totally absent on most of the economic issues as well, I don't see them being particularly welcome in the Democratic Party once elections are over. So I think, you know, they'll probably be able to raise money and they'll be able to get on TV, but I don't think they'll actually exert any influence, and I don't think anybody will really care anymore.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on the personalities not being able to find a home, especially if you presided over the Iraq War. But let's talk about them as a social class, right? So this idea of Biden Republicans, the people analogized to Reagan Republicans, do you think there's been a long-term shift in these voters that's going to continue to define the Democratic and Republican parties?
I don't think the Republican Party will win them back. I don't think, you know, as you pointed out earlier, like, Romney and Ryan didn't win either. In fact, they lost much worse. And given like I was talking about with the actual morality or moral justifications of capital and how, you know, the Democratic Party has completely owned those voters on the big cultural questions, I don't think the Republican Party can get those voters back. Maybe a few of them, whatever, but hard to see that coalition being put together again. And that leaves the party with, you know, a choice, which is go for the working class voters but lose more donors, or just try to hold on, you know, control the Senate, try to control as many of the kind of non-democratic institutions as possible, and beat us the slowest retreat you can.
Yeah, I've generally share the same analysis, Julie. So it's like, you can either be permanent minority or you can try to become the party of the working class. Permanent minority is a lot more lucrative. Working class would require exercising power. And we'll see whether that's going to happen. This is my ultimate question, which is that, look, I think we both will generally concur that the great promises of Trump's 2016 campaign certainly didn't work out. He governed much more like a typical Romney-Ryan Republican than any of us would have. But the guy still won. I mean, he got razor-thin margins, at least, in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, in Michigan. I mean, he won Macomb County in Ohio. He won Latinos in Zapata County in Texas. Just his rhetoric alone has me questioning, how much does the policy even matter here, Julius? How much of it is just culture war? Maybe it's more than I ever wanted to admit. What do you think?
I mean, like I was saying, I probably will sound too cynical regardless, because that's what I am. if everyone makes the critique that the U.S. is a plutocratic system dominated by donors controlled by, you know, these various elite groups, corporate lobbies, et cetera. If you take that as true, then the mass politics just becomes infotainment. And I think there is basically a lot of truth to that. And to the extent that a lot of the mass politics plays a role today, it's sort of, you can maybe build a platform and you could frighten some of the elites with it to maybe go along with you. And if you were maybe a little bit more skilled or disciplined or whatever than Trump, you might've been able to shift some institutions with the power you had. But absent that, the default position is, this is the circus and the infotainment and the culture wars. And the truth of the matter is, you know, questions of 230, industrial policy, pharma, you know, all that, it's going to be settled by really technocratic little debates behind closed doors with industry lobbies and various other elite institutions.
Yeah.
I want to get into this working class thing a bit, because Sagar, your point about you could either be a permanent minority party or you could be the party of the working class, that's an important distinction. But what I'm concerned about, and we saw this during the RNC, is that there's actually a third way of becoming the working class party, which is that you just say the word working class a lot, you heighten cultural divisions, you sort of focus on the owning the libs part of it. And obviously that's going to be a part of the Republican coalition, but you overemphasize it too much. And you sort of try to have it both ways. So I get the sense that that's the direction that police are sort of going to go. And people will just accept the idea that you are working class, but you're going to do it the wrong way. You're not going to focus on the technocratic part. So my cynical take here, if we're just going to dial that part out for this last bit of the show, is that there isn't going to be any reason for most GOP politicians, at least for the next 3 or 4 cycles, to embrace the broader things, because the donors will largely be there for owning the libs. They'll actually really like that. Because Julius, I like your point about how the people who are funding a lot of these things are people in these remnant industries. They dislike the woke left. They dislike the universities just as much too. So I definitely think there's a huge market for owning the libs and just references to working class people.
Yeah, for sure. The only thing that cuts against that is, you know, sort of ambition, political ambition cuts in all directions. So, you know, whether Trump ends up winning or losing, the Republican Party pretty much starts whenever we have the result, or primary. I mean, Republican primary starts whenever you have the result. It's going to be a crowded field. And, you know, some of them are, you know, there's of course going to be, I don't know, Nikki Haley or whatever running the old George W. Bush style line. And then there's going to be others that, to differentiate themselves, will go in other directions. And at the end of the day, people like to win, and you never know exactly where that takes people. But certainly the dynamic you mentioned is the one that we've seen mostly in the last few years, and it's not a huge stretch to imagine that continuing.
Yeah, I think that's one that I absolutely is important. And this is kind of brings us to our final section here, which is that one of the most important books, I think, for Marshall and I, and was Michael Lind's New Class War, which we've talked a lot about here on the podcast. And he makes a point, you know, in terms of the cultural politics, that there really is no winning, that there is a series of negotiated settlements from both sides. So do you think, though, that one of the, because currently one of the narratives out there is about, oh, there's all these minorities and they're woke on the cultural issues and they're with us, and actually we're this like social conservative, ascendant, populist majority, that could actually lead to losses in the future? And in general, how should political coalitions think about settlements along these cultural lines? Because on the industrial front, on the economic front, the financial part, and so much more things, I completely agree with you. I mean, these are the animating things behind my politics. But just given how much culture is an important part of this, we have to have a good answer on how and what that looks like in terms of battle lines, when to fight and when not to. What do you think?
My guess is that the cultural settlements will not be sort of driven by the working class right or whatever. My guess is that, you know, given the extensive divisions, internal divisions within the Democratic Party as well, which of course is, you know, represents the dominant culture setting institutions, that it's more likely. And sometimes, you know, the worst thing that can ever happen to you is to get what you want. And again, if Biden wins, he has, you know, no constituency once Trump is gone, because everybody on the left, you know, he was everybody's last choice, basically, or second
right.
choice. And you're going to have all these big battles between, call it the establishment left or the gentry left and the so-called far left. And there's, of course, a lot of interesting economic divides in those as well. But my guess is that the cultural settlements will be driven because those internal divisions force, you know, kind of new weaknesses and new issues on their end that would create a space for a right side of it if they're careful and thoughtful to negotiate a bit of a peace for themselves. But I don't think, you know, I think given that the left dominates the culture, any opportunity for such a settlement is going to have to come from some kind of crack in that armor.
That's interesting.
So my last question is this. It seems to me that one of the biggest mistakes a lot of people on the right and the left in terms of populism made after 2016 is just leaning a little too far into the realignment. So something that I'm hearing is that people, and this is, you referenced this earlier, but there's a lot of people who are a little too online, but there's a lot of very online people on the right who are embracing the fact that Wall Street was so pro-Biden, that are embracing the fact that the suburbs went so pro-Biden, and are basically saying, good riddance, they're out, it's sort of over. But if we look at our politics and think of coalitions, there's no world where Republicans could literally lose most of the suburbs every 4 or 2 years and have an actual ability to govern. So there is going to have to be some ability to keep those losses to a minimum and far below what they were last night, regardless of how it turns out. So how would you think people on the right should approach that question? How should you think about this if you embrace the idea of a working class GOP, but also recognize that you do need to keep the losses in the suburbs to a minimum?
Well, I can only talk about what we've sort of done a little bit, and I am fully cognizant of all the reasons to be skeptical of this strategy and why it, you know, it's difficult to make it work. But I don't know. I don't think it's about so much about reclaiming lost Republican voters, which we talked about earlier, as much as maybe picking up some new defectors. And there's a lot of interesting people on the left who increasingly find themselves without a natural home over there. But who actually have spent a lot more time thinking about economic policy, have a lot more experience in some of the technocratic elements of policy making, which of course, you know, the left doesn't treat as evil, and has made some attempts to actually do that. That might be recruited or at least temporary allies in some of this. And to me, in the near term, at least, that seems like the most promising outcome. But again, like I said, there's all kinds of reasons why that may not work either.
Mm-hmm. And then final question here, Julius. How should we think about Trump the man and himself? I kind of think of him as he opened a new space and allowed me to think new thoughts and a new hope for what was possible in America. I think that's probably around in the same realm of how you think of him. After 4 years now, and you know, possibly he might still be the president, he might not. How do you think of him as the man?
I think, you know, he ran as a builder, talked about himself as a builder, but what he's really good at is destroying. And we actually did have a lot of stuff that needed to be destroyed, still do, as a matter of fact. And he was pretty good at that, but he never seemed particularly interested or capable. And of course, they had a lot of issues as well, to actually build a new thing, to actually lead a realignment, whatever. And the best explanation for this I've heard is from Bruno Macias in his book, History Has Begun, who just, you know, talks about Trump and actually the entire American kind of cultural experience as this desire to live these kind of media fantasies as an end of themselves. So we probably think of it as like, oh, we want to get media publicity or whatever for causes. People go campaign on these issues so they get elected and then implement the issues. But, you know, for an increasing number of people today, it seems like actually just getting the media controversy in and itself. And that does seem like an applicable description of Trump. But the last thing I'll say is just that, you know, there are a lot of kind of younger people, mid-level people in that administration who I think did try to do a lot of really good things and maybe still can. And regardless, I think, you know, it will be helpful to have kind of those people coming out of this experience and trying to build something new and better for the future. So I think even if the Trump administration ends in a couple of months, it will still have some positive aspects going forward.
I do have to ask a follow up here. What is still left to be destroyed? Right. We have to give people some sort of agenda to come out of this with.
Well, I mean, certainly I think like the university sham meritocracy complex is very strong.
You're starting small.
It's interesting how like to take like really granular issues like our foreign policy expert class, which like doesn't even know anything about other countries. Like we develop foreign policy experts by like teaching them foreign policy theory rather than like how to speak other languages and go to places. We send our State Department people to these countries for like 14 months and then we bring them back. And then we wonder why we have no local expertise in these places. Like that's all still there. That hasn't gone very far. All of these failed sort of Bush Clinton administration people are still around. And then of course, you know, we haven't even gotten into some of these structural elements of the economy, whether it's how we treat intellectual property rights and so on, in ways that are extremely economically problematic, to how we set up financial incentives to reward kind of value extraction and share buybacks and so on over investment, and all along down the line. So I think, you know, unfortunately, there's still a fair amount of things to be destroyed. Though, again, if we've learned anything, it's that, you know, destruction's not enough. And you know, we need people to actually reform things and have positive agendas. And I think reality will support that going forward if there's anyone who wants to take the opportunity.
I certainly agree. Julius, it's been such a great episode. Thank you for catching up. It's been a fraught time, and we've really looked to you for a lot of inspiration in your work over the last couple of years and continue to do so. So thank you, man.
I was watching a Slavoj Žižek podcast recently, and someone said something similar to him, and he's like, well, then you're really in trouble.
Yeah, let's just hope that this doesn't look out of date by tomorrow morning and everything stands by 12:04.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be better. Guys. That'll be the best.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, thank you, guys. Julius.
See Thanks.
You
later.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Obviously, we're all still waiting to hear what the election results are, but we will definitely talk about it more on next Tuesday's episode.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast, all the work that we do here. We will see you guys next week.